I am Plant on the Line in Vancouver, British Columbia at thecommentary.ca. A new poetry collection from the poet Douglas Burnett Smith is a good way to reflect on this Remembrance Week. In Burden, he tells a story of 17-year-old British soldier Private Herbert Burden, who was shot for desertion during the First World War. The collection examines many themes, from courage and valor to trauma and shell shock, what we now term as PTSD. The poems in the book are told through the voice of Lance Corporal Reginald Smith, who is an ancestor of the author of this book. Reginald Smith had befriended Burden and was ultimately commanded to join the firing squad that killed Burden. It's a powerful collection, and it gives one a lot to think about as we mark Remembrance Day tomorrow. Douglas Burnett Smith is a Governor General's Award-nominated author of Voices from a Farther Room. Burden is his 17th book of poetry. He joined me on the line from Antigonish, Nova Scotia, where he teaches in the English department at St. Francis Xavier University. Visit DouglasBurnettSmith.com for more. This new book is published by University of Regina Press. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Douglas Burnett Smith. Professor Smith, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's great to be with you.
For people listeners, how are you related to Reginald Smith?
He was my uncle. He was my father's half-brother, so he's as close to being an uncle as you can have, I suppose.
Right. And these letters that he wrote, how did they get to you?
They came into the possession of my aunt, and she had them for a number of years in the attic, and then she rediscovered them a number of years ago, and she said that she had them, and I said I'd be interested in looking at them, and so she gave them to me, and then when she passed away, they came into my possession.
Other than yourself and your aunt, who you mentioned, have there been other people, family relations, I mean, who have seen the letters or have read them at all?
No, nobody else has.
Have say, academics seen them?
Yes, some academics have seen them.
Other than yourself, sir.
Yes. I teach at St. Francis Xavier University, so people in the history department have looked at them and have actually used them in their classes.
I ask that because I'm sure that they would be used in a historical context like that. I haven't seen them, obviously, but from the poetry in this book, one would think that there is something of say, historical value in them.
Well, absolutely. I think that eventually they'll probably go to the Canadian War Museum. So that's what I'm hoping that they'll end up.
Indeed. This turn of phrase that's in one of the poems, it's been ringing in my head ever since I finished reading the collection a couple of days ago, the weight of their obedience. I mean, it's a hell of a turn of phrase.
Mm-hmm.
It's an evocative way to describe what all these boys must have felt.
Yes, indeed.
There must be a weight on yourself, as not only as a relative, say, someone descended from. Are you descended from? I guess you would be. Yeah. I confuse it with ancestor. You know, I was going to say you were an ancestor of, but I that's probably incorrect. Is there obligation of some sort on you as you're reading these letters, say? I mean, there must have been, otherwise you wouldn't have written these poems.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I did feel an obligation after I lived with them for a while. I mean, I didn't. It took me a while to, I suppose, absorb the weight of them, as you mentioned in that phrase. But it became a weight that I just had to finally shed by giving Reg Smith a voice and giving Private Herbert Burden a voice. These are two people who died in the most horrible conditions imaginable. And I really felt that I owed it to them, or at least I owed it to my uncle. And through him, Herbert Burden, the 17-year-old boy, who was shot to death by his own comrades. So, yeah, I felt that weight, and uh, it, it was considerable weight. It wasn't an easy process to get through.
And it's the weight on soldiers like Smith himself, and I'm referring to your uncle. Mm-hmm. It's an awful weight when to think if you don't follow, say, the orders, you would be executed yourself.
Exactly.
And then have to carry that for the rest of one's life.
Yeah.
What I found fascinating about this collection is there's an empathy here on your part as the writer of these poems. And I just don't think it's from Smith's letters. I think you seemingly have embodied what it was like for Smith or for Burden.
I hope that I have. I hope that it's as convincing as it can possibly be, because the letters were, you know, the letters are the letters, and they're not all about, by any means, they're not all about one thing. Some of them are just newsy letters to his parents. Oh. Hi, I'm here, I'm doing this and that. And most of them are like that. And they just became the germ of the collection for me. I mean, they just sort of became the jumping off point. And then, you know, as the cliche goes, some of this is true. All of this happened. Some of it is true. So, you know, that's the way I had to deal with it. I couldn't imagine. I can't imagine what it was like, really, to be in that position as a 20-year-old or as a 17-year-old. And dealing with all of the stress and the danger and the atrocities that they faced on a minute-by-minute basis. But I had to try. And so I think that the book accomplishes some of that. I think it achieves some of that that fear and vulnerability and weight, as you say. At least I hope it does.
Do you find your role as the poet, as the writer, say, that of the translator as well? I mean, you write in the introduction that there was some censoring
yes.
of these letters before they'd come back to this country.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find yourself writing between the lines, if you will?
Oh, all the time. I mean, you have to do that. There comes a certain point when you're doing, I mean, it amounts to research, and it comes to to a certain point where you have to say, I have to just stop looking at these things and dig into myself and see, you know, how deep I can go to find that kind of empathy. And you just have to stop, otherwise you become imprisoned by the research. So, I mean, I've done that before with other books, and I knew at a certain point that that's what would happen, and indeed it did. You know, I just put the letters away, and then I wrote.
Yeah, I keep coming back to the letters, though, and I'm wondering, does Smith have a sense of who he's writing to? And I'm not just talking about his parents, but I mean, to someone else, maybe posterity, perhaps even.
That's hard to say. I don't know. I'm so close to those letters; it would probably be hard for me to judge at this point. Mm. But I think that, you know, I haven't looked at the letters now for a long time. But if I were to look at them again, I suppose I would still think that he's really just writing back to Mom and Dad in Winnipeg, mm-hmm. telling them, you know, that he's okay and that, you know, not to worry. And that's what the bulk of the letters do, is he's just trying to reassure his parents and his siblings that everything is fine and the war will be over soon. Don't worry. Little did he know, of course.
And when you're writing these poems, are you thinking about how young these guys are, say?
Yeah. How young, how inexperienced, how naive in a certain way they are, and yet at the same time, how they are plunged into the depths of an experience that one can't even begin to imagine. The youth and the tragedy of their demise, their collective demise, it's pretty overwhelming.
Yeah, I can't. I mean, I'm 38, and I can't imagine being, say, half my age. and going through what they're going through. It really does have a formative experience in terms of this generation, say, and just how the country ended up.
Mm-hmm. Well, for somebody like Burden, who enlisted illegally and lied about his age when he was 16 and then was shot to death when he was 17, I mean, for him, he was a kid. He was a boy, basically.
Yeah.
I mean, verging on manhood. But, I, you know, the way that I think of it is that he just didn't have a clue what he was getting into. Of course, most of them didn't. But especially somebody that young who thought this was going to be a great adventure.
Yeah.
You know, I'm going to defend king and country, and it's going to be a hoot. And, of course, it was anything but.
In their time, the understanding of shell shock obviously is very different than it is today. But what did they know? And just how wide was, say, the knowledge of that?
It wasn't very wide at the time. I mean, as the war progressed towards the end of the war, 1917, 1918, people were starting to clue in to the fact that all of these people who are collapsing under the stress of the atrocities that they're living with are not, they're just not cowards. Mm. They just don't have whatever capacity other men have to deal with this. And so there were strategies undertaken to begin to try and deal with it. But even then, by the time the war ended, I don't think people fully appreciated what these men had actually suffered from. I mean, we call it post-traumatic stress syndrome now in 2020. But, you know, 100 years ago, there was no post part to this for these guys. The guys who made it through and survived, that never went away. For most of them, at least, you know, in my reading about the whole situation is that it was perpetuated. It never went away until their last breath.
And it's something that they have to live with and yet can't talk about. And that's the great tragedy of it.
Yeah. Many of them couldn't.
Yeah.
Most of them couldn't, or most of them wouldn't talk about it. That's true. In both world wars.
Yeah.
In both.
This goes into something that I've been thinking about since I finished reading the collection. We don't give enough thought to, say, the consequences of war, whether we're near conflict or, say, support conflict even, or the people who decide whether we go to conflict, go to war. This is something that I guess humanity hasn't even really thought about, regardless of the number of wars we've had to encounter, say, or endure.
Yeah, I think that that's really a good point, and I think that now I think we're probably beginning to realize the possible consequences of it. You know, I was reading a review of Don DeLillo's latest novel, which is called The Silence, and the epigraph of the novel is a quotation from Einstein, and he says, "I don't know what weapons are going to be used to engage in World War III, but I know that in World War IV there will be sticks and stones." Mm-hmm. So, you know, I think we're beginning to realize that, you know, the war to end all wars is going to be the next one.
Mm.
At least I hope we're starting to realize that.
Yeah, it's one of those things where a lot of us realize that, but not enough people, I guess, right?
Maybe, yeah. Yes.
What can one do in poetry that one couldn't do in prose or nonfiction, say? These poems, for me, as a reader, have just illuminated these I was going to say characters, but these are actual people. They've illuminated them so well. And you write, you teach writing. Is there something in poetry that's unique to any other form of writing, say?
Well, of course, the first thing that comes to mind is that it's more compressed than prose.
Mm.
And, you know, I've never written prose. I mean, I've written essays, but I've never written prose fiction to any degree. So, you know, that my métier is poetry, and that's what I feel that I'm best at doing. But that compression, I think, lends itself to this particular subject because of the nature of it. You know, certain things that I, you know, glean from the letters are certain things that I glean from my research about, you know, how these battles were fought and what weapons were used and the consequences of suffering a wound and things like that. You can isolate those things in poetry and highlight them perhaps more effectively than in prose. So at least that's the way that I thought about it when I started to tackle the project.
The words in poetry, obviously, because of, you know, you use so few of them, have to be so precise.
Yes.
How do you write? Do you write quickly at all?
No, I write pretty slowly. The older I get, the slower I get. But it's, you know, it's fits and starts. I mean, when I started the project, I wrote feverishly or furiously for several months and for rough drafts of a number of sections because the book is divided up into sections.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote furiously for several months, and then I laid back and I let it sit there for a while, and then I came back to it. And that's usually the process that I find myself engaging in, is that I write and then I, you know, I let it simmer for a while, and then I come back and see how good or bad or somewhere in between it was, and re-examine it, and then, you know, take things from there.
A lot of a lot of writing is rewriting, as they say, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did you find you're hacking away at a lot of the stuff, say, or cutting it down?
Yes, of course. Yeah, you write way more. At least I do. I write way more that's going to end up in the final product. Yes, absolutely. There's all, you know, it's like a big block of marble. You look at it and you just start chipping away at it until you can see the figure inside that you want to polish. And so it's that kind of a process for me. There's always a lot of material there, and I need to fine tune it.
Are you a writer who has to write in a specific place, say? A lot of writers write at a specific time of day as well.
Yeah, it used to be that I wrote a lot at night.
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger. I would be up all night and I would look, see the sun rising, and I'd say, oh, I've done it again. But now, no, I have a family, and so I'm up early in the morning. I probably do a little reading, and then I sit down and will write for 3 or 4 hours if things are going well. Mm-hmm. And that's it. And then I put it away. And come back to it the next day if time allows.
What do you write on? Are you a computer guy or paper and pen, say?
I'm a paper and pen guy, first of all, for the first drafts, and then the second, third, and umpteenth draft, I'm on the computer now, yeah. Yep.
What's the difference between, say, good poetry and bad poetry?
Oh, wow. The difference between good poetry and bad poetry. Well, I think a good poem is something that convinces you of its emotions, that there's a sincerity there that's inescapable. And bad poetry is just false sincerity, I think.
You know, the title, Burden, works in so many ways. It's obviously the name of Herbert, but I think it carries through not just in Smith's letters, but I guess in your work as well, as you introduce these people. Some people know who Burden is already, but for someone who say had no idea who he was, like I did. I didn't know who he was until I read the book. There is a weight. I mean, I'm going back to this idea of the weight on you, in terms of portraying these people as well as you have. I mean, is that still? I mean, this book is out now.
I still feel that. I mean, you know, it's an escalation, an enormous weight off my shoulders now, as it is always when a book comes out. It's no longer your baby. It's grown up and it's out in the world and it has to fend for itself, as the cliche goes. But I mean, you know, when I read about Burden, and after, you know, reading my uncle's letters and putting two and two together, you know, I just really couldn't believe that I was given such a gift. I mean, with that name, because as you say, it works on so many levels. And I couldn't title the book anything but Burden after that. So, you know, the Burden is the name of the, you know, the kind of invisible protagonist of the collection, and it's the burden that my uncle had to carry for however long he had to carry it until his own death. Yeah. And the burden of all those others who were there. We don't know who those other people were in the execution, the firing squad that shot Burden. So it was their burden. And then the burden of the millions of others on both sides, on all sides, that had to experience that hideous, hideous so-called Great War.
I mean, there were hundreds of people like Burden who met his fate. And,
over 300.
And then you know, thousands, I would think, who were like your uncle, Reginald Smith. Again, this theme of contemplating or considering the consequences of war, I think, it's something that I've been thinking about just a great deal since reading your book. I'm groping for a question, but I really just want to say just how I mean, it made me angry, I guess, after reading your book.
Oh, that's interesting.
Or frustrated, at least, that we still, 105 years later, still don't have...
We still don't get it.
No.
Yeah, well, see, I mean, I grew up in Winnipeg myself, and I didn't live far from a street in Winnipeg that was originally called Pine Street, and that was renamed in 1925 Valor Road, because on Valor Road there were three young men who were awarded the Victoria Cross for bravery in World War I. Two of them didn't make it home. One of them did, and he actually went on to serve again in World War II. So, I mean, that was part of my growing up, is knowing that there were these brave men, three of them on one street, you know, in Winnipeg, which is a remarkable thing in and of itself.
Yeah.
So I think that really infiltrated my consciousness at an early age. And then knowing that I had an uncle who died in the same war that these two guys and the one guy survived in. And then another uncle in World War II who died at Al Alamein on my mother's side. So, you know, I mean, those things stick with you. And then, you know, I wrote another book earlier book on the war in Sarajevo.
Uh-huh.
And so I hope that this is the last, I really actually hope that this is the last time I'll have to confront the subject, because, I think I've had enough of it now, to be quite honest about it.
Yeah, and that's the other interesting thing is as we've learned over the years, the effects of war pass through generations, and in your case, at least, they've been fodder for your writing, but it's a crass way to put it. But they have certainly weighed on your thoughts, haven't they?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's just been something that's been inescapable. And inevitable for me to have written on, I think.
Yeah. I noticed that you tweet as well. How does Twitter lend itself to poetry?
It's only a recent thing for me. I've entered into that realm a little reluctantly because I mean, I don't do Facebook. I know that I would just be wasting a lot of time scrolling around on Facebook if I were to do that.
Yep.
So it does lend itself to the short form, and I've been tweeting little things on Twitter for the past 8 months or so, and it lends itself to really, really short, cryptic little things, which I like to write as well. I've written this book. This is a book-length sequence of poems, so they're all interrelated, and a lot of my books have been like that. But I also enjoy writing little haiku-like poems as well, and so Twitter really lends itself to that. As a medium, it really lends itself to the short poem.
Yeah.
So I enjoy that too, but not nearly as much as writing longer stuff.
Yeah. As I told you, I have thought about this book a lot since I put it down. I actually read it on a screen, which is different than, I guess when you close your laptop, I guess it's it's putting it down. They're beautiful poems in this collection, so I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to me about them and this book, and good luck with it.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate your taking the time to get in touch. It's been fun. Thank you.
The website for more is at douglasburnettsmith.com. The book is called Burden. It is published by the University of Regina Press. Douglas Burnett Smith joined me on the line from Antigonish, Nova Scotia in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Plunton.